I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Fighting continues in the streets of insurgent-held Fallujah, Iraq, and today Pentagon officials say at least 16 U.S. troops have been killed in that city and elsewhere in Iraq since Operation Phantom Fury began yesterday. Earlier today, the interim Iraqi government imposed an overnight curfew in Baghdad. There are new reports of hundreds of masked gunmen roaming the streets of nearby Ramadi, and a group of Sunni Muslim clerics called for a boycott of the upcoming elections as threatened because voting would be held, quote, over the corpses of those killed in Fallujah and the blood of the wounded. Well, for the latest from Fallujah, we turn to Boston Globe reporter Anne Bernard. And Anne, you're embedded with troops, and that means you're under some restrictions about what you can and can't say. But as much as you can tell us, where are you?
I'm in Fallujah. I'm in a neighborhood towards the eastern section of the city. It's a residential neighborhood. It's completely deserted right now, except for American troops that are clearing houses and blowing up buildings that they think are used by the insurgents.
What are some of the problems that the troops are anticipating? We're hearing from some analysts that this is the first urban warfare since World War II, and these are narrow streets. As you said, as they get deeper into them, they're not quite sure what to expect. What are they expecting?
Well, the tanks have weapons that are best used at long range. So the weapons are not being used in their ideal situation. But they also have trained for this ever since the problems in Somalia where U.S. troops were ambushed and killed without the proper backup by armored vehicles. They've been training for this kind of scenario.
You're speaking of Mogadishu, and people are worried about another Mogadishu, especially since the insurgents have, you know, they're on foot and they have RPGs and they can run around corners. Is it anticipated that the U.S. troops and the coalition troops are going to get down on the ground and be running around house to house in that kind of almost hand-to-hand combat?
Well, yeah, and I shouldn't give the wrong impression. I am with an armored company from the 1st Infantry Division of the Army, and they did go in with heavy armor and some infantry that are riding in Bradley fighting vehicles. But the Marines, who actually went into the most heavily insurgent-controlled part of the city, they went in Humvees with much less armor. So the reports are that they've been having heavy fighting today. There are also Marines in this neighborhood going house to house and checking to see what's going on in individual houses.
Yeah. And can you tell casualties on either side? What can you see?
Well, again, it's a very strange way to see a war from the back of an armored vehicle. The platoon I was with reported that they killed a dozen people last night. I didn't see any of it. So it's hard to know whether those were people that were clearly carrying weapons, whether there was confusion in the darkness, how much civilian housing was destroyed in the process.
You write in your article today that some of the American troops expressed frustration at the Iraqi troops that they're supposed to be working closely with. What happened?
Well, it turned out that it was a problem with the Iraqi troops' vehicles. The troops I was with were securing an area where there was a school and a mosque that were believed to be an insurgent center. But they ended up waiting for hours and holding up their own advance through the city because the Iraqi troops did not arrive. It turns out that was because their vehicles couldn't make it past some of the concrete barriers that had been erected, which the tanks were able to maneuver around. But today we had a worse incident with Iraqi troops, which is really probably the most threatening moment that we've faced so far. The squad I'm with had taken over a house to use as an observation post, and all of a sudden the house came under heavy fire. And it turned out it was a group of Iraqi soldiers, and some of the soldiers said, oh, I think they did it on purpose.
That can't be building any goodwill or trust, which is imperative, you know, in wartime.
Right. Well, these troops are somewhat better trained than the Iraqi National Guard that a lot of soldiers and Marines have expressed frustration to me about over the past year in Iraq. But obviously it's still not a perfect partnership.
Mm. And we're hearing stories of how this invasion sounds. And I know mortar fire combined with sound from mosques, combined with the PSYOPs trucks that have been brought in by some of the U.S. troops, you know, blaring AC/DC music.
Those I haven't heard. But last night, we were standing on the roof of a building and looking out over the city. The only light you could see was from one of the main mosques. And the only noise that you could hear that was not the noises of battle was the sound of prayers coming from that mosque, kind of chanting. Then you would hear sort of thunderclap type sound of RPGs. You would hear the rattle of heavy machine guns. So it's a strange combination.
Yeah. And Ann, it's been a long time since we've heard this many reporters embedded in the middle of conflict. How safe do you feel?
Well, I'm certainly surrounded by a lot of armed men and a lot of armor. That said, you know, we're always keeping an eye out over our shoulder when we get out of the vehicles. We're running from the vehicle into a building.
It's urban warfare.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Anne, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania has come under attack from members of his own party for remarks he made regarding abortion. Specter is next in line to be chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which considers judicial nominations for federal courts and for the Supreme Court. And there is concern among conservative Republicans that Specter may stand in the way of judicial nominees who don't support Roe v. Wade, the decision legalizing abortion in the U.S. On CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday, Senator Specter said he's never had an abortion litmus test.
I have supported Chief Justice Rehnquist for confirmation as Chief Justice when I knew he had voted against Roe versus Wade. I supported Justice Kennedy and O'Connor and Scalia, and I led the fight to confirm Clarence Thomas.
ABC News is reporting this morning that, according to the senator's office, aides to the senator say that calls from conservatives who do not want Arlen Specter to become chair of the Judiciary Committee are coming in at a rate of 2 to 3 a minute. Well, Senator Specter himself joins us now on the line from Washington. And, Senator, thank you.
I'm glad to talk to you. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, and now maybe you can clarify for us, what did you say and what did you mean?
I said that you could anticipate problems on the confirmation process with the Democrats filibustering, which there's a lot of evidence as to what they've done. And there is no question that my record is loud and clear that I've never had a litmus test. When Chief Justice Rehnquist came before the Senate for confirmation, he'd voted against Roe versus Wade back in 1973. That was not an obstacle to confirmation. And I don't believe in a litmus test.
Well, was this a warning shot that you were firing across the bow to the president, as some have said, not to pick overly conservative judges?
No, it was not a warning shot. That was what the newspaper said, that Arlen Specter had warned President Bush, but that is factually not so. Fox took a look at the transcript. Rush Limbaugh took a look at the transcript. Others have. And any fair reading of it would be that I had identified a political fact of life as the potential for a filibuster. There's no doubt about that. But I was very respectful of the president.
Well, Senator Specter, what would you say then to your constituents who might be saying from the other side of the aisle that you do support a woman's right to an abortion and that you should have fired a warning shot because that's one of the reasons they put you in office?
Well, I am the only Republican who is pro-choice on the Senate Judiciary Committee. The function of the Senate under separation of powers is to give the president latitude in his nominations. There is a range. Our job is to determine if the nominee is qualified, judicial temperament, background, academic standard, professional practice. And then it's up to the court to make a decision. In a context where you've had Roe for more than 30 years in Casey versus Planned Parenthood, an opinion written by three justices appointed by Republican presidents, it's still a matter for the court. That is the rule of law, and I respect that. And I think we get there traditionally without opposing a litmus test. And my record is very plain on that, going back for a couple of decades.
Well, Senator Spector, you just mentioned something I want to touch on. You said that your comments were picked up by Fox News, by Rush Limbaugh. And I heard you last night on Sean Hannity, the conservative talk show host on his radio program, being grilled on your conservative credentials. What would you say to those on the left who say, you know, you just got into sort of the meat grinder from the right of your party that does distort words or at least comes down pretty hard on politicians, on others for their comments?
Well, I would say that that's part of the pay grade. I don't like labels. And my own view is that America wants to be governed from the center. But where you have a reporter like Brian Wilson, very respected Fox News, said, quote, "I looked at the tape very closely. Senator Spector was the victim of some spin on the part of some reporters who took some comments and were looking for kind of a good headline out of it," close quote. Well, that sort of goes with the territory. And I'm not unused to criticism, but I think the facts are very plain.
Well, but Senator, I don't want to interrupt you, but you just have over a minute left. I do want to ask you, we're going to be talking to Lynn Nofziger from the Republican Operative in a moment, but just to touch on what we've been talking about, the, as you said, meat grinder you just went through. We know we've been talking about the cultural divide that exists within the country. Some are seeing it within the Republican Party as we speak about this issue. Is there concern on your side of the aisle that Americans seem not to just to disagree, but to disagree so fundamentally on issues such as abortion?
Well, we have factions of the party which have very strongly held views, but I believe we can pull them all together in a big tent. And I think the president is committed to doing that. And he was very explicit in the third debate that he does not intend to have any litmus test. And I think it is very, very important to the Republican Party that it be a broad-based party. And it's not only important to the party, it's important to the country. And if one faction of the party can dictate to the United States Senate who's going to be the chairman of the committee, I think that's a real problem for the party and a real problem for the country.
But they would say that anything else waters down their agenda, which is to get a judge on the Supreme Court that will perhaps take a closer look at Roe v. Wade. We just have a couple seconds.
Well, I'm sorry if I can't comport to your time on a soundbite. You're dealing with very fundamental constitutional issues, and they don't lend themselves to a couple of seconds. But to try to answer your question briefly, we have a constitution that has separation of powers, and the president is the person who nominates people for the court, and the Senate takes a look to decide whether or not they're qualified. And I don't believe in a litmus test, and then it goes to the Supreme Court, and they make the decision. That's the rule of law, and we all have to respect that, whether you're from one faction of the party or another.
Senator Arlen Specter, speaking to us from Washington, thank you so much, sir.
Glad to talk to you.
More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We just spoke with Senator Arlen Specter. We turn now to Lynn Nofziger, former aide to Ronald Reagan. And Lynn, you said I can call you Lynn. Welcome.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to people at National Public Radio.
Well, thank you for joining us. And let's touch on something that we have just been spending a few minutes on, and that is Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania. You write in a recent op-ed piece that one of the unpredictable things in the future for the Republican Party is that the new Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee will be the liberal and unpredictable Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania. How do you view his recent comments?
Well, I've heard two of them. I've heard the initial comments or read them, and then I heard his explanation of them. But you know, Arlen Specter is a moderate Republican. Some of us would call him a liberal Republican. He has pretty strong views, and I view his comments as indicating that he's not going to just automatically take the people that the president sends up and approve them. But I do think this. I think that he will give them a hearing, and I think that he will eventually report them out of committee And I don't think you can expect a heck of a lot more out of him than that.
Well, you know, there's been strong reaction, as you know. I heard Arlen Specter being grilled on Sean Hannity yesterday, the conservative talk show host.
Yeah.
And there's a sense that, and we're going to talk in a moment about, you know, a lot of people have been saying that the Republicans have to reach out to Democrats and heal that divide. What about the divide within the party?
Well, of course, there is a divide within the in the party. But there's always divides within our political parties, and there are always divides within the country. And the idea that you can heal them by going in and changing somebody's mind or by changing your own mind doesn't seem to me to make much sense.
Well, that's been the theory of the Democrats for a long time, who are known for, you know, having more disparate opinions on things. But in the Republican Party, it's said that the orders have been sent down to, you know, march pretty much lockstep behind especially the president's domestic agenda.
May I point out that the people in Congress are not appointed by the president or the White House. They are elected. They have their own constituencies, and they will make their own decisions. And any orders that come down from the White House and say you will march in lockstep, you know what's going to happen? They're going to thumb their nose at them.
Do you think, or is there feeling in the party that the Christian right, especially after this election, has too much influence on the Republican Party?
No, I don't think that's the case. You know, this idea that there is one group out there that is influencing the party, I just don't think it's necessarily true. There are people in the Congress who agree with some of that, but don't agree with all of it. But would somebody point out to me a member of the so-called Christian right who is a leader who is really has some influence on the Congress? I don't see it.
Some would say Rick Santorum.
Rick Santorum, who supported the re-election of Arlen Specter. Rick is a good guy, but he doesn't have any strong national constituency.
Well, yeah, as you know, exit polls showed, and this was a story from last week, that many people did vote for President Bush because they said he shared their moral values.
Well, surely, but that goes beyond him being a born-again Christian. It goes to where he stands on gay marriage. It goes to where he stands on right to life versus choice. But I don't think that they say, well, he's a born-again Christian, and therefore anything he believes is okay by me.
Yeah. Well, Lynn Nofziger, do you think that the Republican Party has to now reach out to Democrats who are outraged about the use of the word moral to apply only to those issues, which it's been interpreted that way by some people?
Why should the winners reach out? Why isn't it time maybe for the Democrats to reach out to the Republicans and say, hey, you people represent a majority of the country. Let's look at where you're coming from and see if we can't find some way to agree with you. I find it interesting that it's always the Republicans who are being asked to reach out.
What they are saying is that they have a mandate.
Well, who is saying they have a mandate? I don't think that they have a mandate. I think, as I wrote, the mandates, for the most part, are largely in the eye of the beholder. You look back and Lyndon Johnson beating Barry Goldwater, Dick Nixon beating George McGovern, Ronald Reagan beating Fritz Mondale, overwhelmingly, I think those were mandates. But I don't think that there's that 3.5 million votes, popular votes, and what, 20 now, 18 or 20 electoral votes, are really all that much of a mandate.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of President Bush saying that he had the will of the people at his back and he had political capital, he was going to spend it.
Well,
but
of course he's going to say that. I would say it, too, if I'd been elected president, but just because he says it doesn't make it so. Remember, he's a lame duck, so he can go push his own agenda, and the only thing that he's got to do is recognize that you always make compromises in dealing with the Congress.
But I guess I just want to ask you, Lynn Nossiger, in the few seconds that we have, are you one of the conservative Republicans who Thomas Oliphant writes about today in the Boston Globe? He says many conservatives see the Republican Party as really good at running campaigns and winning, but then they don't follow through. They don't actually change things. They don't implement conservative policy.
I don't totally agree with that. I agree with some of it. But, you know, nobody, when they win in this country, ever gets all that they want.
Lynn Nossiger, former aide to Ronald Reagan, Republican Party stalwart. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Robin, it's a pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a shortage of doctors in Canada's national health care program has led to private practices, some charging up to $1,000 a month. Is the Canadian health care system going American? Also, the Polar Express flies onto the big screen. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. It's a piece of paper that Boston Red Sox fans say is responsible for the curse that dogged their team for decades, a pact with the devil. And the contract-sending slugger Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees was on the auction block on eBay. But you're too late. Bidding ended at midday today, and bids failed to meet a so-called reserve price. Rhode Island philanthropist Alan Feinstein, who's owned the contract for 11 years, thought that now that the Red Sox had won the World Series and broken the 86-year-old curse, it was time to sell the dastardly deed and give the proceeds to charity. Here now's Bob Oakes spoke to Feinstein about the contract, how he came to own it and use it to raise money.
I heard that it was being put up at auction at Leland's Auction House, and this goes back 11 years in 1993. And I said, wouldn't it be a good thing to get that contract back to New England? We certainly can't get Babe Ruth back, but if we get the contract back and we use it to do good things with, well, at least we're getting some good back from that infamous, terrible mistake we made.
You've sold replicas of the contract before, is that correct?
Yes.
And how have you done with those?
It made over $2 million for universities and anti-hunger agencies throughout New England.
So contrary to the curse, which of course hung up the Red Sox until this year, this contract has actually done some very nice things for the people in New England, especially the poor.
One of the things we started was a school program where we encouraged the youngsters to do good deeds. And the youngsters in Rhode Island schools in our program, since we got that contract and started the community service program, we've done 10 million good deeds throughout Rhode Island. So I credit them with helping to break the curse.
That's Here Now's Bob Oakes. The plan sounds simple. Build a wind farm off the shores of Massachusetts. Provide a clean energy alternative for consumers. But that plan to build a wind farm in Nantucket Sound is running into a lot of obstacles, from politicians who worry about the view to fishermen who worry about their catch. The Army Corps of Engineers has now weighed in, and it concludes the Cape Wind Project would cause only temporary damage to shellfish beds, would not harm fish populations, and would have little impact on protected fish species. As to the view, here now's Fred Tice has the story.
16 state and federal agencies and the Wampanoag tribe contributed to the Army Corps of Engineers report. It concludes that on an average day on Horseshoe Shoals, where the wind farm is likely to be located, one bird could be killed by any one of the 130 rotating giant turbine blades. But the report also concludes that bird populations as a whole would not be adversely affected. Governor Mitt Romney, an opponent of the project, says the problem with the wind farm is not that it might affect wildlife, but that the 417-foot towers, half the height of the Hancock Tower, would ruin the view.
I do not think the wind farm should go forward. I'm not surprised that that the wind farm isn't going to kill fish or kill birds, but that's not the issue with the wind farm. The question is, does the wind farm impinge on the beauty of one of the great natural resources on the East Coast? And it does. It doesn't take a rocket scientist or hundreds of consultants to do an analysis of that. We don't want a wind farm affecting the beauty of our seashore in perhaps one of the greatest tourist attractions on the entire East Coast.
The report concludes that the wind farm is not anticipated to have an effect on the water quality of Nantucket Sound, and that you won't be able to hear the turbines. Jim Gordon is president of Cape Wind, the company behind the project.
The project will produce, on average, 75% of the Cape and Islands electricity with zero pollutant emissions, zero water consumption, and zero waste discharge.
The report did say that some historic properties along the coast would be affected in the sense that you could see the turbines from them, and that boaters would have to be more attentive as they approach the power plant. The report also concludes that the $700 million power plant would create 391 permanent full-time jobs. Cape Wind's Jim Gordon.
The release of this report shows us how we can get to greater energy independence, lower energy costs, a cleaner, healthier environment, and new jobs.
The report finds that so far, the fact that a wind park is being considered has had no impact on property values along Nantucket Sound. Governor Romney says the Corps of Engineers is not qualified to make such a judgment.
Well, the Army Corps doesn't know a lot about the visual impacts that such a facility would have on tourism. And on the ability of people to enjoy the beauty of nature. So this is not an environmental study that's required. This is instead an aesthetic and a business analysis, and that's not something which the Army Corps is necessarily set up to do.
We are not surprised that it is favorable to the Cape Wind project.
Audra Parker is assistant director of the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound, the main opponent of the wind farm.
The process is flawed. We've been saying all along that it's flawed. And so it's not surprising that it is biased towards the project applicant.
Parker says Cape Wind was allowed to hire the principal consultant for the report, but Karen Adams, the Corps of Engineers project manager for the report, disputes that.
We chose the consultant. TRC Environmental was our contractor. The applicant, Cape Wind Associates, is responsible for paying for all the data collection, and through this third-party contract, they were responsible for paying for the contractor, but we selected the contractor.
Environmental groups were by and large ecstatic about the report. Jim Moorberg, president of the Conservation Law Foundation, believes the wind farm would be an important step towards addressing the problem of global warming.
Climate change is upon us. It's not some distant hypothetical problem. You can look at Arctic temperature rise 2 degrees each decade over the past 30 years. Correlate that to massive evidence of melting glaciers, and the picture becomes clear. Sea level rise is already upon us.
Warburg called on Governor Romney to reconsider his opposition to the power plant.
It's time for him to look at the project with an open mind. The same goes for Senator Ted Kennedy, historically a champion of sound energy and environmental policies. He needs to look beyond the narrow interests that seem to be motivating his current opposition to the project.
The wind farm would be visible from Hyannisport, where Senator Kennedy lives. Kennedy issued a statement calling for clearer rules governing the development of the continental shelf. Opponents of the plan have proposed that Congress pass legislation regulating offshore power plants before any are allowed to be built. As for Senator John Kerry, it's a little harder to figure out his position. A spokeswoman for Kerry says he'll support the project if the final report says that it can provide clean energy without harming the ocean environment or the Cape and Islands community. The spokeswoman said Kerry wants to hear from the people of Massachusetts. Once that's happened, she says, then Kerry will make up his mind. A series of public hearings will be held next month, after which the Army Corps of Engineers will draft a final report due next year.
That report from Here and Now's Fred Tice. Still to come, a hard look at the soft sell, from shoes to vodka to politicians. You're listening to Here and Now. The hurricane season was especially hard on Florida this year. Charlie, Francis, Ivan, and Jean pummeled the state, causing damage to houses and businesses, and of course, costing some Floridians their lives. In addition to the toll on human life, the hurricane season caused damage to wildlife. In fact, environmental scientists say the hurricanes reversed most of the advances made to restore Central Florida's Lake Okeechobee. Environmentalists spent the last 4 years restoring the natural habitat there after a decade of overuse. Paul Gray is one of the science coordinators with Audubon of Florida. He described the lake before the hurricanes.
Lake Okeechobee is a huge lake. It's about 30 miles wide and about 30 miles tall. And it's that big lake you see right in the middle of Florida when you see a satellite photo.
Right.
And on the western side of it, we have about 150 square miles of marshes. And these things have all kinds of marsh plants growing in them, and that's where, of course, wading birds nest and snail kites breed and all these endangered species. And what had happened during the 1990s is we'd kept the lake intentionally very, very deep, and we lost about 75 square miles of that plant life.
Wait, why'd you keep it deep? I mean, what was the point?
Well, we were trying to store water for human use, make sure that agricultural people had enough irrigation water, make sure the cities had enough. But what that did was it made Okeechobee so deep that we were wiping out wildlife, and the lake's marshes have been designated critical habitat for the endangered snail kite, which used to be called the Everglades kite. And basically, wading birds didn't nest out there, snail kites didn't nest, the waterfowl had left.
Too deep.
Yeah, and so the Water Management District and the Army Corps of Engineers realized the problems they'd created, and so they lowered the lake very much. We had a wonderful drought that helped rejuvenate the marshes, and basically all that stuff had finally grown back, and we were so happy about it. And then this year, of course, now the hurricanes have come through, and the lake, as of today, it went up about 5.5 feet during the storms, and it's extremely deep. We had the 100-mile-an-hour winds going across the lake, and we've already lost a whole lot of vegetation. The stuff that's left, a lot of it's under very deep water, and the water's all stirred up and muddy. So over the next several months, one of our goals is to try to see if we can lower the lake and try to help those plants recover and hopefully not die.
Well, as you know, the state of Florida voted for President Bush. It's hoped that that might help move some of the federal funds of the Everglades Restoration Act to help restore part of the Everglades. In the meantime, the state is apparently taking out some loans to do the work that's needed, and that work includes building reservoirs. Why is it important to have a place for runoff water?
Right. Well, our whole system was built based on drainage. We were trying to drain Florida, and it's worked very well. But what's happened is now all the water runs into Lake Okeechobee, and it makes it harmfully deep. And then when it gets harmfully deep, we have to dump that water, and we dump it into the ocean, and it harms the seagrass beds, and it kills oysters and all that stuff. And unfortunately, we have a long dry season, and frequently we have water shortages because we dumped all of our water. So what we're trying to do is build big reservoirs, we're going to restore wetlands throughout the system and try to hold this water. And rather than have it harm Lake Okeechobee and then harm the estuaries, we're going to hold it for human use later, and Okeechobee won't have to be harmed, the estuaries won't, and some of this water we'll send back to the Everglades, which needs more water.
Great. And just a quick question for you, Paul. For people who haven't been in that area and are saying, what's the big deal? I mean, what, you know, all the money for what? For what? What's the importance of the lake?
Well, Okeechobee and the Everglades are a unique ecosystem. And the Everglades has been called America's most imperiled ecosystem. And it's a marvelous treasure. It's like Yellowstone National Park. It's a whole different kind of park, though. It's a big water wonderland. But it also has importance, too, because migratory birds, if you think about where Florida is, most of the birds in North America migrate. All these little wrens and warblers and things that are in your backyard, they all come to South Florida, or a lot of them, and then some of them stay here all winter, some of them jump across the ocean. And if you're going across the Gulf of Mexico and you're a little bird, what you do is you put on half your body weight in fat, and you burn that fat while you fly. Well, if they get here and they can't put on enough weight, and they only make it 99% of the way across the Gulf of Mexico, they die. So it's real important that South Florida ecosystems are healthy, not only because of their inherent value, but we're also a highway link in the annual migrations of billions of birds.
Yeah, and so they'll be flapping around without their way station.
Yeah, and that wren in your backyard that nests in your wren house might not come back if Florida screwed up. So, you know, we really are all linked together, especially by these bird migrations.
Paul Gray is a science coordinator with Audubon of Florida, working on Lake Okeechobee. Paul, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. You can run, but you can't hide from advertisers. And by the way, what kind of running shoes are you wearing and why?
Nike said that they were about the meaning of sports, but more than that, that they were about transcendence through sports. Starbucks said that they were about the idea of community, a place that is a third place, that is not home, not work. Benetton was, of course, selling multiculturalism, racial diversity.
That's social critic Naomi Klein speaking in the Frontline documentary The Persuaders, which airs tonight on most public television stations, and describes techniques used by marketers to sell everything from sneakers to most disturbing politicians. Media critic Douglas Rushkoff is the correspondent on tonight's documentary. He joins us on the line from his office in New York. Douglas, hello.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, tell me, what's the point in doing this? Because we almost feel as if we know about advertising. We know it's everywhere. What don't we know?
Well, it's funny, you know, because the title of the show itself, The Persuaders, is kind of based on Vance Packard's old book, The Hidden Persuaders, except now we're just calling it The Persuaders as if it's not hidden anymore. You know, and indeed, we all do know that we're being marketed to constantly. And we all know that the television shows we watch are sponsored and that there's, product inside them and outside them, that it's one big kind of wallpaper of advertising. And I think maybe what we don't look at is our own complicity in all this. In other words, what we don't look at is the fact that we really do view the world through the lens of marketing and advertising, that we relate to one another and to our cultural institutions really as consumers more than participants.
And to our political institutions as well. I mean, we also know how important political advertising has become, but what is happening in political advertising that maybe we don't know about?
Well, we found two main trends in political advertising that were disturbing. The one was embodied by a Republican pollster, Frank Luntz. And the interesting thing about him is, you know, what he talks about is how he can develop language to figure out, you know, what people really want. So he'll do focus groups, and the conceit is that what they're doing is helping develop policies based on what people really want. But what they're really doing is basing language for the policies they already want to do on language that will appeal to us.
In fact, we have an example of that. Here's Frank Luntz, again, as you said, a conservative pollster and advisor to candidates. And the topic of discussion is the estate tax or the death tax. Let's listen.
For years, political people and lawyers, who, by the way, are the worst communicators, use the phrase estate tax. And for years, they couldn't eliminate it, but the public wouldn't support it because the word estate sounds wealthy. Someone like me comes around and realizes that it's not an estate tax, it's a death tax, because you're taxed at death. I'd argue that is a clarification. That's not an obfuscation.
Doug, doesn't he make a point?
He does make a point. You know, it's a clarification in a way, but it's with a very particular bias. I mean, he's also the guy that changed the term global warming into climate change, which he says is more accurate, or tax cuts into tax relief. But it's about, changing the public mindset or changing our votes by changing the language around an issue. And I don't think it has anything to do with helping portray an issue more accurately. It has to do with portraying it in the way that his clients, whoever happens to be paying him, are going to benefit.
Yeah, you mentioned that you sat in on a focus group, and you also traveled to a company that's the largest data mining company in the world. Tell us about Axiom.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the other main political technique even right now is called narrowcasting, and the object of the game is to be able to advertise to different people differently so that, you know, if you are pro-gun, then you will get the anti-gun control advertisement. If you're pro-Bible, you'll get the advertisement saying John Kerry's going to ban your Bible. So there's this giant company, Axiom, and what they are is basically just rooms filled with computer banks, and those computers have records on pretty much every American. I mean, all but two of the 9/11 hijackers were listed in this company's databases. And what they know is, you know, what kind of car you have, whether you have call waiting on your phone, how far you commute to work, if you've bought things online from companies that sell that data. You know, they know what you bought, whether you pay your bills. So they've got a tremendous amount of information about you. Now, not all that information is directly applicable to how you're going to vote, but what they can do is model different things. They find correlations that may or may not have anything to do with voting. So they might find that swing voters in a certain area are more likely to have call waiting on their phone. So this is a way that they can model the people they want to go after so they don't have to send a direct mail or knock on the door of every single person.
I think people would be surprised to find out what you find out, that there are, in fact, 70 demographic groups in this country, and that's how they're sliced into those 70 groups by advertisers. And then there's hundreds of subcategories beneath that.
Right. I mean, and the object of the game for the advertiser, whether they're political or traditional, is to really slice and dice us into our individual consumer tribes and be able to relate to us as such. And you know, when we're talking about buying a car or subscribing to a magazine, I suppose belonging to a consumer tribe isn't such a bad thing. But when we're talking about electing our officials, I don't know if we really want to be divided into separate consumer groups. I don't know if we want to be relating to our government as consumers rather than as citizens.
Well, do you think that these ads further divide? I mean, we've talked in this program and on others about this huge cultural divide that many are seeing just, you know, tearing across the country. And do you think these new political ads in particular further that divide or just reflect it?
Well, I think they further it by really through this customization. I mean, in Ohio, there were campaign workers going from house to house with a Palm Pilot that had ads on them specifically created for that individual voter. You know, so basically with raw computing power and now with, you know, easy, you know, on-the-fly video editing capability, you can basically give different advertisements to each voter so that a candidate can really be very different things for different people.
Wait a minute, you mean they were showing them to the people as they found them?
You knock on the door, you know who's in that house, is someone who has this magazine, this many car doors, commutes this far to work, makes this much money, owes this much money, and you assemble an advertisement directed particularly for that person to hit the hot button issues that you know that individual voter will respond to.
Yeah. Well, Doug, I want to thank you very much for joining us in this several minute commercial for Frontline's new documentary.
Thanks.
Who will bear this wonderful morning?
Douglas Rushkoff, correspondent for the Frontline documentary, The Persuaders, which airs tonight on public television. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
Get up with the river and put it in a box for me.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
So I can see it at my leisure wherever they go wrong.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.